Thank you, John. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience, and while the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking this. John, as retail food consumers, we all have the power to express our values at the checkout line, every one of us here. But we're often faced with difficult choices there, and particularly when affordability is an issue. I was recently at the grocery store and was pleased to find an affordable package of ground beef that was grass-fed and organic, but when I squinted at the label, I saw that it said, product of New Zealand. Mm-hmm. When we are faced with these choices between organic or local, what do we think about? What should we consider?
That's a great question. I don't think there's any simple answer to it. I think people have to make food decisions based on taste preferences, their own circumstances, economics, and the like. I would and have spent much of my career encouraging people to eat local food, even when it's a little bit more expensive. My wife and I, about 20 years ago, since I was in this business, figured we needed to live this. And what we did, at that point in time, we were finding that local meats, local vegetables, we grew a lot of them ourselves, we could usually find them fairly affordable. Local meats were fairly expensive, often as much as twice as expensive. Here's what we did. We bought all local meat and we ate half as much of it. It was probably a really wise decision. So there are trade-offs, and you have to make the decisions that are right for you. But part of it is we need to make sure our food system is serving all people. When I talked about how it's great that we have a lot of these small farms that are producing a really high-quality product that comes with a premium price, we want to see more of that happen. We want to see more people raising their own food. But we also need more of this agriculture in the middle. We need more farms in New England that are at a high enough scale that there are some economies of scale, and the cost of some of those food products for the general population can come down.
Thank you. Here's another one. What would you say to a selectman in a small New Hampshire town, hypothetically, of course, who is afraid to preserve farmland because he's worried about his town being built out, or wants to have his town built out maybe to improve the tax base?
I will say, sit down with me and I will teach you things that will blow your mind. Because the truth is that sprawling development always ends up costing a community more. There have been a number of detailed studies. In fact, this is one of many areas where AFT has played a huge role nationally. We've done 70 of these studies. They're called cost of community service studies, where we've looked specifically at pieces of farmland, tax values, different uses, and what it means. And the bottom line is, if you are a selectman worried about your tax base, there is absolutely nothing better than to keep farmland in your community. Cows don't go to school. And that's just the straight up economics of taxes. If you then add into that the fact these are farms, which are local businesses, which are contributing to the economy, it is a win-win. So if any of you know of any selectmen like that, send them to me.
We have some great questions here, John. What effect will global warming, or climate change in general, have on the future of farmland? For example, will new farmland become available?
So AFT, back 20 years ago, did this huge national study called Farming on the Edge that looked at how we were losing farmland. It was actually the impetus for some of us in Maine to say, wow, we need to worry about this issue, and then we contacted them, and the rest is the history I outlined earlier. We're redoing that study, and we have some benefits that we didn't have 20 years ago. We have better data, we have better GIS, but we're also working into that study an ability to look prospectively at what will happen. We're not just looking at what's happened over the last 25 years, we're going to look at what will happen over the next 40 years, given both different scenarios of development and different scenarios of climate change. There is no doubt that climate change will have a huge impact, is having a huge impact on farming. It's already having an impact in New England on when you get onto fields, on pests, on pollination, on severe weather events. I could go on and on. But it is going to shift very much places you can and can't farm in this country. A lot of prime soils are prime in part because of climatological factors. They don't stay prime if they're not getting rain. And that's going to happen in many parts of this country. So it's a huge issue. In about another 3 months, when we have state-by-state data on this topic, AFT, American Farmland Trust, will be going public with this new study. I have no idea what's in it yet, because the work is not done. But this is a critical area that we are all going to have to spend a lot of attention on. There are going to be winners and there are going to be losers, but there's principally going to be losers. And we need to take every step we can to minimize the losses.
John, how do we assure we have farmers that own their land, or do we have a nation of sharecroppers?
Well, I alluded to that earlier. I really think, I'm not always a great capitalist, but I do feel that farmers who own their land, that's a model that makes a lot of sense. It puts the long-term responsibility for that land in the hands of the person who is working it, and it's a great encouragement and incentive to follow the best farming practices. We are seeing a lot of young people, because farmland is often unaffordable, looking at leasing options far more than we're interested in doing so even 10 or 15 years ago. And sometimes that makes a lot of sense, and often they're doing it in partnership with very progressive and open-minded landowners, and sometimes they're doing it in partnership with great land trusts. I think all of those models are great, but the bottom line is I do think that it also makes sense, and I would love to see the bulk of our farmland remain in private ownership. And I think it would be a shame if our agricultural system moved in the direction of what is, in essence, a sharecropping system. We have to resist that and make sure we don't have huge corporate holdings of farmland that are then run by farm workers at the bidding of those large corporations. Farmland protection and the other work that AFT does is a critical part of that, because we make it possible often for land to be affordable for incoming farmers, and then we give tools for farmers to be successful on that land so they can stay on it.
Here's an important question to clarify a topic you were speaking about earlier. Will an agricultural easement help a farmer financially, and how does that work?
Yes, it will, and it could be in a myriad of ways depending on the circumstances. If it's someone who's buying land, they will immediately be able to get onto a farm for a reduced price, sometimes a significantly reduced price. They're only paying for the value they need, which is that land for farming, not for other rights that, as I noted earlier, is unimportant to them and what they want to do. If a farmer sells an easement, that's cash that, as I noted, usually a lot of that goes to the bank initially, because you're changing the deed on the property and the property has less value. And so the bank, depending on the situation with your mortgage, might need to take some of that. But that's good too, because what it means is the debt service on that property goes down. So farmers immediately lower their operating costs. But usually when a farmer sells an easement, there's also cash. And I could go on and on with about how New England agriculture has changed over the last 400 years. We always have this idea that things are relatively stagnant, but it's been amazing how we've changed our agricultural production based on market forces and other things. There's always a need for innovation, and farmers hardly ever have access to capital for innovation. We've seen so many easement deals free up cash that have allowed the farmer that wants to get into direct marketing to build that farm stand, or the orchard that wants to have a bakery on site to build that bakery. So farmland protection almost always has a direct financial benefit to either an incoming farmer or an existing farmer.
John, do you include ranchers among farmers?
Absolutely, and if you look at AFT's materials, we always talk about farmland and ranch land. There's a lot of ranch land in this country, a lot of it privately owned, a lot of federally owned land that ranches lease. It's responsible for a lot of our food production. It's obviously not the same amount per acre as intensive vegetable production, but it's critically important. And it's one of those, I talked about the diverse array of people on my board and some of the interesting conversations we have, especially over cocktail hour, when you start getting these cowboys on our board with their big hats and their boots chatting. It's for New Englander like me, it's a different world. But it's all part of agriculture. And I tell you, I have such respect for farmers and ranchers. And some, you know, New England right now, farmers are sort of being revered as being almost rock stars, and that's wonderful, it's great. That's not the case across a lot of our country. But almost every farmer to a person or rancher I have ever met, they care deeply about the land and what they do, and they are trying to be really good stewards. And they generally only fail when everything is stacked up against them. And when they're given the tools, they more than anyone want to be good environmental stewards.
Could you provide some more details about carbon farming techniques?
Sure. Well, as I noted, a lot of the carbon that's in our atmosphere has been released from the soil, tilling it too much, leaving it open. If you see farmland that is fallow and just there's bare ground out there for 6 months out of the year, that's both releasing carbon to the atmosphere, and at the same time, there's not an opportunity to have a cover crop on that that could be actually sequestering carbon and building soil health by fixing nitrogen and other things. So carbon farming is kind of a hot new term, but I think it's a good term because it puts the importance of farming front and center to people who care deeply about climate change. But the notion of carbon farming is really nothing new. It's a collection of all those practices that in essence build up the carbon, build up the organic matter in your soil. So examples would be no-till agriculture, where you don't actually plow up the ground in order to plant a new crop. You actually drill seeds down and use different crops that work together. Better rotations of land, so nothing is ever bare. Better use of cover crops that sequester carbon, fix nitrogen, build up soil health. There's a whole range of different practices that are possible. This is not new stuff. In fact, most of this was being done and has been done, at least in some cultures, continuously over the 10,000 years of agricultural history. But we got away from it with a lot of industrial agriculture, and there's a chance to return it. And it can be done at a higher scale. You know, big farms can do things better, small farms can do things better. This is not something that only works for the backyard garden. In fact, the backyard garden, I hate to say, I don't put a cover crop on my half acre in the winter. I let it sit there. Cover crops are better suited to a larger piece of land in some ways. So the questionnaire wasn't necessarily going down this path, but I just wanted to make the point that building soil health is one area, one of those places of common ground where almost every farmer, big or small, conventional or organic, sees value.
Well, John, I'll finish on a very easy and important one, and that is, how do I sign up to be a member of the American Farmland Trust?
Wow, I guess my card got in, huh? Well, I did leave a few membership brochures back there at the back, and maybe we can get some in for the refreshment hour as well. I have a ton of bumper stickers, and my feel about bumper stickers, I mean, we'd love you to become a member, but just putting a bumper sticker on your car or two, take as many as you want if you're promised to use them. So that's the answer. You can get the brochure. You can obviously find us online. I always hate to the sort of sales pitch part of the presentation, but the truth is we need more people who care about the stuff and are informed about this stuff if we're going to make a difference. Thank you again.
You've been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org and stay up to date on our events by liking us on Facebook. The program next Sunday will feature Tom Seeley, who will be presenting Honeybee Democracy, What Bees Can Teach Us About Collective Decision Making. Thank you again, John, for a wonderful talk. Now, please join us in the parish hall and enjoy some refreshments, which have been most generously provided by the greengrocer in West Peterborough. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank Achille Agway in Peterborough for the beautiful flowers and for sponsoring today's talk. If you asked a question that was not answered during the program, please feel free to ask it during the reception. Thank you so much for coming today and making possible this lively dialogue. We'd like to hear from you about your experience today, and we encourage you to fill out the blue card and add your name to our email list on the clipboards available at the reception. Thank you again.